Yeah, so the way we planned this was we'll split it half-half. I'll be talking more about data analysis. So basically, so this is going to be pretty low-level tutorial in terms of how you do astroseismology. So I'll talk a bit about data analysis. What do you measure, and why do you measure it, and how do you measure it from data? And then Victor will go on in the second half, tell you about how you can use the measure, the observables, to actually infer stellar properties such as mass age and so on. So I'll start off with some brief introduction to astroseismology. Now, this is going to be very similar to what I've told about the conference a couple weeks ago. So those of you who've been there will recognize a few of the slides, but I figured that not everyone was there. So I'll start with that as well, and then define the observables that we want to extract from the data. So oscillations in stars are caused by a variety of mechanisms. The ones that we are mostly interested in for stars like our giants and our sun are convection-driven oscillations. So these are pressure waves, p-modes, that are driven by the convection zone, the outer convection zone in stars like our sun and in red giants. For hotter stars, it's opacity mechanisms that drive more coherent pulsations. But in this talk, we mostly care about what we call so-called solar-like oscillations or convection-driven oscillations. So for any oscillation mode, you want to determine a couple of characteristic quantities. The first one is the radial order n. That's simply the number of nodes if you go from the surface to the center of an oscillation mode. So basically the number of zero crossings from the surface to the center. So that gives you the number of radial nodes, the radial order n. And then you have the spherical degree, which is the number of node lines on the surface of the star. So if you take just a cross-section, imagine you take a cross-section through the star and you follow a mode from the surface here, and one mode that travels all the way to the center will basically have no node lines on the surface. It will be a radial mode, so it's basically just spherically symmetric. On the other hand, this mode here travels to a certain depth, and that gets deflected, bounces outwards, bounces inwards again. So this will form a non-radial mode. In this particular case, it will have two node lines, and it will oscillate non-radially. And if it has two node lines, we call it an L equals 2 mode, so a quadrupole mode, L equals 1 mode, a dipole mode, and so on. So how do we observe oscillations? Typically in brightness variations, that's one of the easiest ways to do it. So you have an oscillating star, changes in temperature, changes brightness as a function of time. These are the p-mode oscillations in the sun, a period of about 5 minutes. Now, almost every astroseismic analysis is actually done in the frequency domain, simply because there's stars usually oscillating many modes at the same time. So you frequently see power spectra or amplitude spectra, so amplitude versus frequency, and for the sun, you'll get this result. Each of these peaks is a single oscillation mode that's traveling for the sun. So there are some applications where you do it in the time domain, but usually you stick to the frequency domain when you do an astroseismic data analysis. So in this broad picture of looking at this power spectrum, we can define a few quantities already, which are what we call global astroseismic quantities, because they globally describe the power spectrum. First one is the frequency of maximum power, which is basically the frequency at which this power spectrum reaches its maximum. It's roughly Gaussian-shaped. You see that in other stars as well. Numax has been proposed to scale with the acoustic cutoff frequency. That's the largest frequency below which a mode gets reflected at the surface, which is related to the pressure scale height, which you can relate to basically surface gravity and weakly dependent on the effective temperature. Now, the second main observable is the large frequency separation, delta nu. The large frequency separation is defined to be equal to the inverse of the sound travel time through the stellar diameter. So CS here is the sound speed, which you can relate to fundamental properties for stars under certain approximations, like an ideal gas, for example, and you can relate it to the mean stellar density. So these two relations allow you to calculate the mass and radius of a star. They're basically the astroseismology 101 in a way. That's the first thing you want to determine from the power spectrum. We call them scaling relations because we scale properties that we observe from the sun to other stars to calculate the masses and radii. And a lot of these are approximate relations. They're not the holy truth. We've had a lot of discussions over the last few weeks over the accuracy of these relations. I won't go into detail about that. But suffice it to say, this is the minimum information that you can extract. Now, more information is obviously contained in the individual peaks. So if you extract those and you plot them modulo the large frequency separation, you're basically stacking up orders on top of each other. and you form what we call a Michel diagram, which is a really fundamental tool in astroseismology. It's very often used. So again, it's this frequency modulo, this large separation. This is the separation between modes of the same spherical degree L and consecutive order N. So when you do that, what happens is that you get ridges of modes of the same spherical degree that line up almost vertically in this Michel diagram. And you can see that apart from the large separation, you of course also have small separations. So this is the frequency difference between modes of different spherical degree. Now, the small frequency separation is related to the sound speed gradient. This can be qualitatively understood by the fact that modes of different spherical degree travel to different depths. So remember, the L equals 0 mode travels all the way to the center, L equals 2, a bit shallower, and so on. So by forming frequency differences between modes of different spherical degrees, you're basically sensitive to the sound speed gradient, and hence the stellar age. The frequency spacings, as a side note, they vary with frequency. Both the large and the small separations vary, so this difference varies as you go upwards in this diagram. This is due to what we call acoustic glitches, basically changes in the sound speed profile due to things like the base of the convection zone, ionization zones within the star, and so on.
May I ask a question?
Yep.
If you would have a perfectly vertical line, mm-hmm. what would that correspond to in stellar structure?
Well, a polytrope, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you measure this in a protostar, you should see absent ionization zones, no curvature.
I don't know about that. I don't know if anyone actually calculated a model. This is the sun up here. So basically, we don't expect it to be straight for the sun. I'm not sure about protostars. Maybe it's supposed to be more vertical. For red giants, which are shown later, they're more vertical, but basically because we observe less radial orders. But so you see variations in all stars.
Is the information on the average distinctness too, or in actual how the separation is changing with the frequency of one of them?
Sorry, say that again.
Is the information in the average separation of these two lines, or is it in the particular shape?
In the particular shape. So what we usually do is you basically try to calculate the small separation as a function of radial order. So you do it frequency by frequency. And then you get this oscillatory pattern in the frequency separation.
You match them to this?
To a model, yeah. That's what we should do.
So quick question there. Are you going to go into how you assign those frequencies and orders and things in this?
So how we know that this is, this is 0 and this is 2. Well, we know for the sun because we know the sun very well, and then we extrapolate to other stars because they show the exact same pattern, basically.
But would there be stars where you only see, say, 0 and 1 and not 2 and 3?
You do. But you can still figure it out. I'll go into that later. But it often happens that we see 0 and 2 and not 1, for example. Then you're still well off. There's a good reason not to not see L equals 3. Because of cancellation effects, the amplitudes are very low, so you don't expect to see L equals 3 in other stars than the sun unless you have really good data. So what usually happens is you have two ridges and then one offset, which is a very easy pattern to spot when you have actual data. So if one is missing, then you're still sure that it's 0 and 2. But if 2 is missing, then you need to have some prior knowledge of where to look, basically on this axis, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Of where you find the L equals 0 ridge and where you find the L equals 1.
I would say that there is still a bit of information on the average difference. Not as much as the average difference is also giving you some information. For the sun, for example, you have used it.
Just the average 0-2 spacing, for example.
Yeah.
So I was going to show a diagram that plots large versus small separation, where you can see the age spreading apart, the famous CV diagram. We're going to run out of time if I go into that much detail, because we'll mostly focus on the red giants, where that's not that important. Anyway, so this is the sun. And as I just said, so for the sun, these separations are actually quite interesting. For the red giants, they're not as interesting. They don't give you as much independent information on the age. They basically give you similar information to the large separation, but we get additional information for red giants from what we call mixed modes. So if you take a look at these two power spectra, these are now much lower frequency than in the sun. And I highlighted the L equals 1 modes, and you can see this is a bit of a mess because there you get extra peaks. So it's not just one mode per radial order, but you actually get additional modes, a few per radial order. which is due to the fact that P modes, the pressure modes that are excited on the surface, couple with gravity modes, so these are modes where the buoyancy is the restoring force, they live in the radiated interior, they couple with the P modes and cause extra modes to be excited. And you can see that the frequency difference, so the average spacing, so to say, between these mixed L equals 1 modes in this star is quite different from this star. I've mentioned that in my talk. This is a very elegant way that was found a couple of years ago to discern stars that are helium core burning, so red giants that are in the clump, from RGB stars that are moving upwards. They show very different mixed mode spacings. These spacings are measured in period because gravity modes are periodically predicted to be equally spaced in period, versus the P modes that are equally spaced in frequency, approximately. So these are the mixed mode spacings. Now, if you compare that again to the Echelle diagram, this was our sum. So how would a red giant now look like in an Echelle diagram? It would look quite different. So the color coding is not exactly the same, but if you take just the L equals 1 modes, which are red in both diagrams, here's the L equals 1 mode, ridge, and then for the red giant, you get many more modes per radial order. This is exactly what's happening because of these mixed modes, the coupling with the gravity modes that live in the core.
Am I seeing the same point multiple times, or?
Yes. No. It's not the same point. These are actually individual frequencies due to rotational splitting, which I won't go into detail here because it's another layer of information you can extract. So this.
But the diagram is repeated.
The diagram is repeated.
Oh, sorry. That one. Yeah. Okay. So the diagram is replicated twice. Sorry about that. Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
It's replicated.
Compared to this one, simply because if you fold it over, you know, sometimes it basically falls into here. So it's easier to read down that. But it's replicated. That's the case for most of these shells that I'll show you.
So what do you mean it's replicated? These are different frequencies, right? How can you...
No. But this side, so this is...
It's folded.
It's folded, yeah. So this side is exactly the same as this side. It's just, you know, like a phase diagram. It's just replicated. So this side continues on here.
It's just a couple. Left and right is just coupled.
Yeah, but now back to Julio's question, why do you continue to increase the mod number?
Yeah, it's not that dramatically correct to do it. Yeah, you should set it back to zero. Yeah. I was too lazy to do that. And that was actually published in the
I accept that explanation.
So it's a difference in frequency from some...
Yes, both from the absolute position of the frequency. So you take the frequency value, you take the mod, it's the absolute difference from the absolute value of the frequency module, a given separation which you determine as a large separation.
So do you actually do inference based on these points, or do you do inference on the full diagram?
What do you mean by inference? You mean modeling?
Do you summarize this panel by, I don't know, 24 points, summary statistics, and then do inference based on those 24 statistics, or do you analyze the entire...
Well, usually you analyze... So what is plotted here, the color coding is the actual power spectrum, right, with gray shades being the actual power spectrum that I showed before, similar to the sun. And the points themselves extracted frequency. So you say, this is an oscillation mode that extracts its frequency, its amplitude. And usually, that's the information you use for modeling. But to extract the frequencies, you use the underlying power spectrum.
It looks to me like there's some pretty bad degeneracies in the vertical direction, how well you isolate these peaks.
Well, you don't do it in the Echelle diagram. You analyze it in the actual... Where did I have one? Here. This is where you fit your data, not in the shadow.
And what you're seeing is the width.
To make this diagram, you have to assume a certain width in that, like you bin a certain amount in this axis. So
and there is smoothing of the vertical
direction. In the grayscale, please.
Yeah.
That's just to guide the eye, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, usually you wouldn't actually plot the grayscale. You would just plot something like this, like the exact frequencies. So the point here is that you get a lot more L equals 1 modes, which allows you to measure this the mixed mode period spacing that I've introduced before, which is special for red giants because it basically probes the core structure. So it allows you, in first instance, to discern red giant branch stars from red clump stars. But there's also more information in that, and Victor will talk a little bit about that later on. So we've got the large separation, Umax, the small separation, the mixed mode period spacing. So now we're basically full circle on what we can measure from for red giants. So there's one more parameter, which is what we call epsilon, which is basically just the offset of the Elgo zero ridge. So it's defined to be the Elgo zero ridge, but you can measure it for different ones as well in this diagram. So you basically just measure the offset in frequency, so it goes from 0 to 1, basically, as a fractional amount of delta mu, where you find the Elgo zero ridge in your shell diagram. Now, that position varies depending on which star you look at. And it turns out to be quite useful, because it turns out, which we found early in the Kepler data, that epsilon, which is shown here on top, varies as a function of delta mu. So that means if you know delta mu and you assume some functional form between the two, you can basically predict where you will find your Elgo zero ridge. So this is, of course, folded, but you can predict the frequency positions of where you find the Elgo zero mode, where you find the Elgo one mode, and where you find the Elgo two mode.
So what does epsilon zero correspond to? Yeah. Epsilon of one. But that looks to me like a totally arbitrary place you cut off your
scale. Yeah, it should be zero. Sorry, this is actually not the full length. So it should go from zero to 135.1, but I shifted it so okay. The ridges fall where we can actually see them well, and they're not, lined towards the edge. But it's the offset from zero, which is not shown here, but it's usually the offset from zero to the right where you find the Elgo zero ridge. So the epsilon is actually related theoretically to the turning points of the modes, so where the modes reflect back in the atmosphere, and will be in a turning point as well. And one of the most surprising results lately has come from the fact that epsilon, if you measure it at a certain radial order, so very close in to nu max, where you have the most power in the modes, can also be used to determine the evolutionary states of stars. So this is epsilon versus the large separation. And these are RGB stars, so stars that are climbing up the RGB, and these are helium core burning stars. So you can use that as a proxy, which is much easier to measure than mixed mode period spacings to determine evolutionary states.
If you hadn't colored these things, would we be able to see some? Is there like a magic diagonal here? Or?
Sorry,
if you hadn't colored the points, I would have hard time, drawing the diagonal that separates the RGBs from the clump stars.
Right. Well, but so
is that the regular line, or is it some
this line here?
Yeah, that's
right. I don't actually know what that line is.
That
might be a field line.
Yeah, it's just what Thomas decided to put there.
but the color codes come from the mixed mode period spacing. So we know from most that these are for sure clump stars because they show period spacing, which probes the core structure. And the point of his plot here was that you can use an observable, which is a y-axis that's much cheaper to measure, because you don't need the frequency resolution. I mean, to measure epsilon, you don't need a whole lot of data, really. You just need to be able to see the modes and basically determine the large frequency separation correctly. But to measure mixed modes, you need a lot of frequency resolution, a lot of data to be able to actually discern the difference between these peaks here. So it's a much easier quantitative measure. That's why.
Another way of saying it is the color coding was not a consequence of the plot. It existed before.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which is much more reassuring.
Although those with a low delta mu's are not stars where you can actually tell them apart in the spectrum.
So you call it them based on?
Yeah, good question. You can't look at the period spacing for those stars.
Right, because they're too evolved and because the periods are too long. So
but on the other hand, right, they're unlikely to be clump stars, given their position on the equator.
Yeah, I guess
it's... He called them AGB.
Oh, okay, they could be AGB stars.
Okay. So I'm running way behind, and I'm kind of cutting into Victor's time. So let's just quickly sum up the first part, in a way, of the observable. So this is what you can measure in any power spectrum of a solar-like oscillator. And the amount of information increases downwards. So we have nu max, which is just the peak of the power, delta mu, and then all the separations, the mixed mode period spacing. And then you can measure individual frequencies, which would, in principle, give you all of the above. But it's very hard to measure, as I'll talk about a bit later. And upwards is basically how easy it is to measure. So, things that are easy to measure don't give you less information than the ones that are hard to measure, which is not surprising. But just to bring up that point, that's in a way the reason that for probably more than 95% of all stars with Kepler that we've detected oscillations on, we've measured these two things and not all the individual frequencies. So now I'll in the last 10 minutes or so, just briefly and quickly go through how we actually measure things. So this is raw Kepler data. Some of you might have seen this before. I worked with Kepler data. So if you take, this is some red giant that I randomly picked. So if you take a Fourier transform of this, obviously you'll get a bad surprise. What you do is you filter out all these systematics that come from the, you know, the role of the spacecraft and fermion events and so on. There's various ways to do that. It's pretty straightforward to automate, but you basically filter out long period variations that are due to instrumental noise and so on. And then you take a Fourier transform of this, which gives you a power spectrum. And there's a few things you notice in this power spectrum. The first one is that a low, so this is a log-log scale, frequency versus power. You see here at the low frequency end, that's the filter that you've just applied to the data in order to get rid of the artifacts. This can vary depending on what kind of frequencies you're interested in, of course. And you see this increase here in power, this kind of hump in power in the log-log scale, which comes from stellar granulation. So that's correlated noise due to the granules on the surface of the star varying in brightness. These are the oscillations, so that's the good stuff, what we're interested in, what we want to extract, and then finally you get this flat part out here due to white noise. So these are the components, and you have this back, you can see that this background is quite strong, and it varies the frequency quite strongly. So what you need to do, what's usually done, is that we need to correct for this background, and we fit some models directly in the frequency domain. So we call these Harvey laws, which are actually were actually introduced for analyzing solar data. So this is the functional form. It's basically a power law with a certain amplitude, time scale, and a power law coefficient. So these are the individual. So you fit a couple of those. Here's one. Here's the other. And then you have a flat white noise component, which is this, this E here. And then if you combine those, you get basically the solid black line. In this particular model, they've also added a Gaussian term top with a certain amplitude and the center, and in some techniques, the center of that Gaussian that's fitted to the power spectrum defines the frequency of maximum power. So this is one way to do it. There's different variations of this power law, what power law coefficients people use, but that's the general way of analyzing the power spectrum, getting rid, so to say, of the background. Now I should say that this background term here, the granulation, for example, also includes a lot of information that you can use. For example, it has been found that it correlates quite tightly with the surface gravity, so you can just use the granulation component and you don't actually have to measure the oscillations to get to that information, but I won't talk more about that. Now, you've corrected your background, you corrected your power spectrum for the background, and you get a nice background corrected power spectrum with lots of peaks zoomed into where you find the oscillations. Another way of measuring your max, if you don't want to assume that the power is Gaussian, follows a Gaussian distribution, you can just heavily smooth the power spectrum and just take the maximum of that. Now the next part is to determine the large frequency separation. To do that, you can basically, if you've looked at enough of these power spectra, you can tell which modes are which. So these are the 0 and 2 here, and this is 1, and then it repeats 0, 2, 0, 2, 0, 2, 1, 1, 1. And this is simply because of that pattern that we saw before. You always have two next to each other and then one, the other plus one ridge standing by itself. So this is a well-behaved red giant that doesn't show a whole lot of mixed modes. You actually only see one, clear peaks of L equals one. But in order to do this in an automated way, we calculate usually an autocorrelation. So you take a certain frequency range, for example, this one here, and you calculate an autocorrelation. You shift the power spectrum against each other and look for similarities. So this is sorry for the bad resolution, but it's basically a screenshot. So this is the frequency separation of the autocorrelation function in arbitrary units. And you get various peaks. You get one peak, which is at the right large frequency separation. You get a whole bunch of other peaks as well, of course, because, for example, the separation between the 1 and the 0 modes will give you roughly half of the large separation, which is what you see here. But you know roughly where to expect delta nu, and if you're not sure, what you do is you look at the shell diagram. So this is again the same format as before. So it's folded over, that white line does not start at zero. But it's the same thing again. And now I'm not actually showing extracted frequencies, but just the power. So everything that's brighter in red is basically high power. Everything that's dark is low power. So you got the 0 and the 2 and 1 here. So this is how it looks like with the right spacing. And here I've shown a couple of examples of what happens when you use another large frequency separation with a slightly different value. So changing it by 4 and 2% in one direction and 42% in the other direction. So what happens is your ridges get slanted one way or the other because you're choosing the wrong folding frequency.
I mean, is it obvious that the 2% ones look to me plausibly like maybe that's what actually could happen?
No. I've looked at the 2% one. I mean, you can. It's kind of hard to see in this case because you actually you have smoothed over the power spectrum a little bit. If you would actually extract the frequencies and plot it out, a 2% variation is obvious. That it doesn't line up neither of the spherical degrees. So you'd have to tune it better. That's basically why the precisions on these measurements are often 1% or even less. Because if you have a very good frequency of resolution with 4 years of Kepler data, you see these sudden effects when you change the folding frequency. Now, this does not say that the large separation that gives you a density is accurate to 1%, of course. It's a different matter. But in terms of actually measuring this quantity as defined, you can do quite well. Okay, so I was going to flick through a few examples. I might skip those, but maybe just very quickly. So these are a few examples of how you do this. So you can automate this whole thing. You can do the background fits, which are up here, and you get a background corrected power spectrum, the autocorrelation, your shell diagram. And you can do this for a lot of stars automate in an automated way. It takes about 5 seconds per star. It's not very computer intensive, depending on how you do it, of course. But I'll flick through it. Through a few stars, this is a low luminosity RGB star. We'll climb up the RGB. I've marked the 0 and 2 here in the shell diagram, and you'll see how they march over as you move up the RGB because of that dependence of epsilon on the large separation. So this is basically epsilon that we see here, and it's going to march across as we move up. So this is a higher luminosity RGB star going even higher up. This is actually close to the clump. But it is an RGB star. If you look at the shell diagram, the next one has The next one has a very similar NUMAX, but it has a much, much messier shell diagram, and that's because of these mixed modes that I've explained before, because the mixed mode period spacing is larger, you get a lot more modes, and hence the shell diagram looks much different. And you can actually see it in this diagram here as well, that the appearance is quite different. Finally, you move up all the way to the, sort of close to the tip where things get really hard because you don't have a lot of modes. You observe less modes, less radial orders, and determining the actual correct large separation there can get quite tricky, especially if you smooth too much, which is probably in this case, but this is just for illustrative purposes. So we can automate this part. So we've measured delta nu in the max. We can measure period spacings. I won't probably skip over this. Basically, what you do is that maybe I shouldn't. What you do is you use NUMAX to extract the L equals 1 modes where you expect to find them. You use epsilon. So you measure NUMAX. You measure delta nu. You use epsilon to mask out the regions where you expect L equals 1 modes, and then you do pairwise differences of modes that you extract from a smooth power spectrum. This is one way to do it. Another way to do it is to fit an analytical model. One very important thing that I should point out before Victor talks is that the observed mixed mode period spacing is actually not the real gravity mode period spacing. So what you extract from your power spectrum in terms of this mixed mode gravity spacing is not what you want to give your modelers to find the answer to your star. And that is because of the way that the coupling works. The way that the coupling works is that you only observe modes that have a very P-like character, so they have higher amplitudes that you can observe on the surface. The more G-mode-like stars, so where the coupling is different, don't have any observable amplitudes on the surface. So you only observe, this is basically the period spacing and the function of frequency, you only observe the ones down here in light blue. But there are many more G-modes up here, and the model mixed-mode period spacing lies up here. So you need to basically infer from these few modes down here what the true and the correct period spacing is in order to help someone who's modeling that information. There's different ways to do this. One is to fit this analytical model, which Benoit Mosser has published, and which is seen in the middle diagram. Okay, and now finally, the very last point is measuring frequencies. So we've only talked about spacings so far. And the question is, why don't we not just measure individual frequencies and just model the entire information that we have? The answer is that it's a very high-dimensional problem. So for each peak, you have three parameters. One is the width of the mode, because these are stochastically excited modes, you actually don't just get one peak in the power spectrum per mode, but there's a width to the modes because there's stochastic damping and excitation going on. So this is this is described by a Lorentzian profile, which you see up here. So you have a width and a height and a frequency for each non-radial mode, and for each non-radial mode, you can also have splittings between the modes due to rotation. The amount of split modes depends on the inclination, so you have about 5 free parameters. So put that all together, you get about 50 plus free parameters. There's sophisticated algorithms that can do that, but not on a large scale. And it's even more messy for red giants, because as nice as the mixed modes are in giving us more information, they are a headache if you want to automate frequency extraction. You don't know the position of the mixed modes a priori. The splittings can be about the same order as you mix, the rotational splitting can be at about of the same order as the mixed mode spacings. The modes have very different lifetimes. So basically looking at this, comparing this, which is a dwarf star, which is, you know, very nice, you just get one peak after the other, and this power spectrum, which is a red giant, you can see it's obviously more messy. So doing this in an automated way for tens of thousands of stars is at the moment impossible. Okay, and with that, I'll leave you with the observables, the summary of the observables, and Victor will take over, and how we can convert that information into something useful for us. Yeah, any questions on anything while we can set up?
Well, I have a question regarding the using epsilon to separate RGBs from clan. Mm-hmm. Would this be a viable thing to do for tests, for example, where period spacing?
Of course, yeah. So that's the first thing too. I guess Victor will show it as well. If you don't have 4 years of data, but you only have 70 or 30, you won't get the frequency resolution.
70 days.
70 years. Which you won't get the frequency resolution to measure the period spacing, but you will get it to measure itself. But you have to. That's basically one of the conditions to claim that you actually have to take the oscillations. You need to find something that's regularly spaced, and if you have that information, then you can use that with the resolutions.
All right. Thank you. So, I see a few new faces. My name is Victor Silva Aguirre. I'm a postdoc at the Stella Astrophysics Center. And Daniel and I were asked about to get this tutorial today, and I'm going to tell you the interesting part in my opinion, which is actually extracting stellar parameters from the seismic data. So just to get you started, first of all, I'm not going to speak about dwarfs, because for the galactic archaeology, clearly we don't care about them. But this is basically, sorry for the planet people, but it is what it is. I'm not happy about it.
It's interesting planets around the area.
So basically, this is a problem that we're dealing with, right? What I have here is just an example of keel diagrams, so effective temperature vessels log G. I put 3 different isochrones at 5, 10, and 14 gigayears at solar metallicity. You see the RGB phase and the clump and then the AGB. And then you see isochrones at 14 gigayears, which basically have different metallicities, which is numbers that you can easily associate with any spectroscopic measurement that you want to believe. I mean, if you claim less than 0.1, you should get out of the room, right? And I cleverly put a typical spectroscopic error bar there in between, right, with a log G uncertainty of 0.1, and I think I put 150 or 100 Kelvin uncertainty in the spectroscopic determinations. So basically, the classical parameters tell you zero about the star. And this is the problem that we're trying to deal with using a source as well. The question is exactly, how can you determine stellar masses, radii, and ages accurately? So I'm going to start with the conclusion, so you can doze off right after this. And what I want you to take away, the takeaway message, is actually something that Aldo presented in the conference last week. What you have here is the age distribution for a red giant star of log G 2.9. This is just the probability density function. And the red curve is what you obtain if you use spectroscopic data from the Gaia ESO survey. So what can you learn about the age of the star? Nothing. That's the main conclusion. If you have seismic data, on the other hand, you can get a nice probability distribution function with that. Well, you can determine a medium, uncertainties, different ways.
And that's because of the plus minus error bar on that log G?
Yeah. And eventually, it's
the same star?
Sorry? Yeah. So this is what you get with spectroscopy.
It's not the same style of format.
But it's the same parameters, right?
Just a tiny change will give you a huge change in age.
What you saw in the isochrones, basically, you have no predictive power.
But if I added a, say, Gaia quality parallax.
Well, that's a different story because you have to transform the parallax to luminosity, and we can have that discussion afterwards with the volumetric corrections, etc. And the point is that basically, if you here you have the same for the same star, the case of the mass, so the mass distribution that you get from seismology, so using this delta nu and nu max information that Daniel spoke about, and what you get from the Gaia isosurve is this red curve here, that is basically the same curve that you get if you do this Bayesian statistic that you get from the IMF. Plus the evolutionary speed, just telling the Bayesian method that RGB stars evolve at a different pace than clump stars. So basically, you don't get any extra information from spectroscopy in terms of the age of the mass of the star. And that is the takeaway point. You can do it with seismology, you cannot do it with spectroscopy, end of story. I hope. So I'm going to be focused on how can we extract things with the two main
Sorry. But you had to assume a metallicity to make all of that. Okay, so...
Yeah, you do need spectroscopy. Yeah, of course, you do need spectroscopy. I'm getting to the metallicity and the effective temperature as well. We will use them, but if you just have that plus a log G, you don't get anywhere.
That's not sufficient.
Exactly. We're very happy with that, but you don't worry. But you have to couple that to something that is actually sensitive to the properties of the star. And this is, I'm going to start with these two parameters that Daniel mentioned, the delta nu, so the large frequency separation, and nu max, so this position here and the separation between the peaks. Okay? So, well, this is basically a Gaussian envelope, and PMOS are equally spaced in frequency. And what we're trying to figure out, I'm sorry, to build up with this is the scaling relations that we've been speaking about. So basically, we think nu max scales with log G and the effective temperature, and the delta nu is proportional to the density. So you're basically sensitive to two ratios between mass and radius. And you have the effective temperature folded in. You can just rebuild those equations and basically extract the mass and the radius directly if you measure these two things. So if you have the measurement of the effective temperature, you can get those values without the need of stellar models or metallicity, which is already a bit suspicious, in my opinion, right? Of course, this doesn't know anything about stellar evolution, in a way, right? So any range of masses, radii, for whatever metallicity are possible because of the dependence on effective temperature. So you can put this on top of grid of models, right? You predict your delta nu and nu max from models. You have a measurement of effective temperature and metallicity. You put them on top of grids, and then you determine the parameters out. Of course, then it's model dependent, but on the other hand, you gain the age that otherwise you wouldn't be able to tell, right? And this is something that we're fundamentally interested in. Now, one can wonder if these two parameters, delta nu and nu max, actually have predictive power, if they are sensitive or not to the properties of the star. And I think the easiest way to see it is this plot from Daniel's paper in 2011. This is effective temperature as a function of nu max, so one of these two parameters that we measure from seismology. So this is a purely observational diagram, if you want to call it. And this is just color-coded by amplitude. The amplitude increases as you go up the RGB. So if this doesn't look like an HR diagram to you, you've never seen one. Mm-hmm. So there is predictive power. You can actually see this clump of stars where you have the RGB bump and the RGB clump together. So nu max is telling you something about the evolutionary state of the star, the properties of the stars, maybe even mass, etc. So there is something there. If you plot this instead as a function of nu max as delta nu, you will see something very, very similar. Okay. So I think one thing is to know what you can do with these two parameters, but the other thing is to understand where the difference in the properties are coming from. So just brief introduction, I will say, to understanding what oscillations are telling us about the star. So Daniel spoke about P-modes and G-modes and mixed modes, right? And okay, I'm going to try to do this very not painful as much as I can, but the difference between these modes is that they propagate in different regions. So inside of the star, you have different propagation cavities for different type of modes. And these propagation cavities are defined by frequencies, by characteristic frequencies. So you have an acoustic frequency, which defines the region of propagation of P modes, which is this SL here, this lambda frequency, which depends on the angular degree that Daniel mentioned in the sound speed and the position in the star. And then for G modes, these are defined by the Grund-Weissler frequency, which is basically this definition here, depends on the pressure and the density and gamma 1, etc. So one important thing, I mean, one very easy way to think about G modes is think about stability of convection. I mean, basically, when you have a little blob that changes density with respect to surroundings, becomes less dense, moves up. And this is going to keep on moving up if the density surrounding is higher. Or if the density surrounding is lower, it's going to move back down. So now, convection means that this blob keeps on moving up and eventually it merges, right? And then you're mixing material from the center or from whatever you started. Now, if this blob starts moving up and down and up and down because then it becomes more dense and less dense and more dense and less dense, it's going to start to produce an oscillation. And this is exactly a G mode. So when you have convection, you cannot have G modes. When you have radiation, you can have G modes. This is convective stability, basically. The blobs moving up and down and producing, just like in water, these modes. And why is that important? Because in the interior of the sun, you can see that clearly. So what you have here is a model of the sun from the center to the surface. And these two characteristic frequencies. So the G mode frequency, which is the Grund-Weissler frequency here. And these are different lamp frequencies for different L values. This is L1, 2, and 3. Okay? So G modes, this is exactly the position of the convective envelope in the sun. So G modes can only live in relative regions. P modes propagate just according to the sun speed in another region. Now the important thing is that G modes and P modes here, the frequency of maximum power in the sun is 3,000 microhertz, this is a bit lower. But P modes propagate here and have no idea about G modes down here. They don't talk to each other. G modes don't talk to the P modes either, so you don't observe any of that. And the amplitudes of G modes on the surface are too small for the sun, so you don't observe them. That's a different discussion, G modes in the sun. You can ask Jan his opinion. But they don't talk to each other in the case of the sun. But what happens when the stars evolves up? So you have something like the sun here as a giant and then an RGB star. The lamp frequency stays roughly the same. This is just scale, so everything looks basically on the same scale, although the models are different. But you have the Grund-Weissler frequency of the sun doesn't talk to the P modes that live here. But as you go up towards the subgiants and the giants, the Grund-Weissler frequency increases. So you stop burning material in the center. The star comes out of the main sequence, expands, and the core contracts. Therefore, the Grund-Weissler frequency increases highly. And now the modes that are living here, you have G modes propagating here and P modes propagating out here with a very, very tiny region between them, separating them, the so-called evanescent region. Now the modes can start speaking to each other and they start producing these famous mixed modes that Daniel spoke about. So if you're down here, like in the case of the sun, this is not the sun but a similar sun, you see this Echelle diagram that Daniel showed, very straight lines, the zeros and two and the L equal one. When you start going to the subgiants, you still have the zeros and twos, but the L equal one, they start shifting around. Okay? So they move out of this straight pattern because of the interaction with the core. So they're telling you something about the center. And once you get to something like this in the RGB, you have this mess basically of L equal one modes produced by their mixed character. Now note that the separation of the L equal modes if you go up in frequency changes. Okay? That is basically because they're equally separated in space and not in frequency as the other ones. Period. And that's why the period, thank you. Not in frequency as the other one. And that's why the period spacing ends up being constant. And that is exactly what Daniel showed us before. So what we're trying to do is measure this period spacing to tell us something about the star. Okay, so this is the one that you can measure, and this is the one that you will determine from models and the one that we want to compare. How to get to that point is a different story. Now, What I'm showing here is the evolution of a model. So this is H. We're moving forward in this direction. And this is the evolution of different frequencies. So these dashed lines that you have here are the L equals zero modes and how they change as the star evolves and becomes just larger. So you see that they decrease in frequency. Now the L equal ones are all these other straight lines. They're actually moving up in frequency and suddenly they have this weird curvature, this different behavior. This is a resonance inside of the cavity, okay? This is the point where the modes resonate and increase in amplitude, and therefore you observe something, which is what Daniel showed before, this is now in period space inverse frequency, you observe these frequencies here that although they have mixed mode in the center, G character in the center, they reach amplitudes that we can observe. These are the ones that you observe. These are the ones that you want to model, the pure G modes, the rest of them. But they do have some predictive power. And the important thing to understand in understanding this pattern is that they tell us about the evolutionary phase. So if you have a star in the clump or in the RGB phase, the difference between the two of them is precisely this, the presence of a convective core. So in a clump star, you have a convective core. Therefore, the Brun-Weissele frequency is undefined in the center. In the case of an RGB, you don't have a convective core, and the Brun-Weissele frequency is much larger. So the integral of, is much larger. And since this is inverse to the integral of the Brun-Weissele frequency, the period spacing, you end up with this. So the value of the period spacing is completely different for the RGB and the clump stars. Okay, and this is basically because of the properties of the star in the inner part. Okay, so as a function of delta nu, basically the star evolved this way, ignite heliums there somewhere, and then send up here in the clump. And these are two completely separate sequences. Now, the question is, how can we use this information to actually determine the parameters of the star, so to break the degeneracy in this problem that we had? So the takeaway point of all that is that stars, which are different in the interior, they give us this information through their period spacing, and we can use that as a prior in the evolutionary stage of the star. Okay? So I don't have this situation anymore. I know that the star is in one of the two sides just by observing its modes. Okay? So this is just a little exercise that I did, almost comparable to the Gaia ISO survey data. So what I have here is just few evolutionary tracks, all at the same metallicity to make it simple, between one solar mass and two in steps of 0.1. And this is a typical error bar that you get from spectroscopy. I think it's 90 Kelvin, I was generous, and 0.1 in log G. So if you just break down in terms of effective temperature, you end up with models in that region. So everything in any mass fits. So you don't get any information from the effective temperature just on the mass. Now you have the information from delta nu. So these little blue places is where you have basically the same density at a given effective, at different effective temperatures. So that restricts your parameter space really much compared to what you had before. Should have put the log G there. Now, then you have the nu max, which is a constant log G by the square root of the effective temperature. And this is the solution that we usually provide using the grid-based method, where the effective temperature, the nu max and the delta nu, meet in this particular diagram. Of course, if we fold in the uncertainties in the composition, etc., we end up with a large error bar. But this really pins down the position of the star in the RGB, and you get really, really a precise mass thanks to that.
Is this using metallicity or not?
Sorry?
Is this using metallicity?
Or this is using the central metallicity. Then you do this for the metallicity uncertainties that you have, and you fold this everything into the uncertainty. So you do this for all the metallicities that you have, and those everything goes into a chi-square, producing a likelihood. Of course, weighted by the spectroscopic metallicity. Now, the discussion, of course, has been if these scaling relations actually hold, if we can determine nu max or delta nu. But, I mean, whatever if this holds or not, these are small shifts that are going to move, shift this systematically or not up and down for certain metallicity. But this is the size of the uncertainties that we're speaking about, okay? And then we have the extra layer of information, this period space that we spoke about, that tells us about the interior structure of the star. And if you add that, you end up with something which is basically orthogonal to the other two lines. And again, in this particular case, favor the same solution that you had with delta nu. It's hard to determine, and Daniel actually showed it, but if you have it, you have a really, really strong constraint on the stellar properties. And this is basically the test that we should be trying to do for the scaling relations, using this as a constraint, stars, 30% that we can determine from Kepler data.
And of course, if they don't cross in the same place.
Sorry?
If they don't cross in the same place.
That would be fun. Exactly. That's the interest point, because if they don't cross in the same place as a function of metallicity or whatever, then we can start tuning the scaling relations accordingly. I mean, I think the period spacing is something that we understand much better. Where does it come from? And we understand it theoretically. So not like the nu max relation, which is Well, the interest, of course, is find where the delta p and delta nu match and nu max doesn't, which will be kind of the intuition that we have. That if there's one scaling relation that should fall, should be that one. But anyway, we're speaking about a few percent, even what Sanjeev mentioned last week. It's 2-3% or something like that. So it's, anyway, completely different ballgame than what you have if you have all this spectroscopy.
Could you measure the metallicity from this? Like, or could you say, forgive metallicity will cross, rather metallicity might not cross, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you could do the exercise.
But you can get the posteriori distribution if you do your projection, right? And then go and check what you measure.
So you're supposed to wonder, what is it that you need from the spectroscopy? What is it? Is it just the temperature and nothing else? Or
to get a mass. The difference is to get the age in your metallicity.
Yeah, the evolutionary time scales are completely different depending on metallicity for the same mass. So that really, really pins it down. And actually, that's the next plot that I have. At least you can see the same thing for age, right? I mean, you see the variation. Delta nu crosses up here, nu max crosses down, and then the delta p.
And this is
down,
and again, this is for a single metallicity.
Sorry?
This is for
a single metallicity.
And a single heliobond, because we just
Of course. I mean, this is based on one metallicity for a single grid of stellar models. You can fold this in as much as you want, of course, with different, I mean, not only the different metallicities, different delta wow, delta z, different mixing length, anything that you change on your stellar evolution model, you can fold it in as an uncertainty. That's not the issue. Then it's going to increase or not, it's going to be systematic. That's a different story. But the underlying point is that you get this little dot as your best solution as compared to anything here, okay, just by adding this information. And that's why the takeaway message, the thing that I started with, that's why you can do this using seismology instead of this. Just they're very, very sensitive to these two ratios between the mass and the radius of the star.
In that plot, you should just go back.
One more or this one?
Did this one. Did you include appearance spacing also?
No.
So that would actually tighten.
Yes. Actually, if you fold in the information of the evolutionary phase, you can have something like this. If you have only seismology and you don't know, and the effective temperature falls right in between the clump and the RGB, you can easily end up with a distribution that looks like this, for instance, for age. If you know the stars in the RGB, of course, you narrow down even more. This is just basically a prior, so to speak. The star has to be in this evolutionary phase. If you, on top of that, fold in the information of the peer spacing, you narrow that even further. But the issue is for how many stars we can actually determine the period spacing. That's a different story. And in this respect, the process for K2 and TESS is basically what Daniel mentioned as well. So it's the importance of the evolutionary phase. I mean, it's clearly that it's key to know that. If you don't, you still do much better than just with spectroscopy. But it's a really, really important tool. And I think this is something that we need to explore, this epsilon diagram that Daniel showed. This is something that you can basically measure very cheaply, and probably with 70 days of K2 or 80 days of K2, you should be able to measure it for a large number of stars. And the reason why this works is what I'm showing here is just an log GTF diagram of three different masses. Open symbols are in the RGB, and full symbols are in the clump. And we show theoretically that these two things in this epsilon versus delta nu space, they do separate. And the reason is just because of the way the mass is distributed inside of the two stars is different. So you have a star in the clump and one in the RGB. They might have the same mass, roughly the same radius, effective temperature slightly different, but one has a convective core and a different size of a helium core than the other one that distributes the mass inside of the star differently and propagates that towards the surface, and we can observe that in epsilon. We still need to explore this a bit further because they're probably the generators with metallicity. But I think this is a tool that we will be able to use for K2 to put a prior on the star being on the RGB or in the clump phase and be able to determine the properties with the precision that we can do right now with the nominal mission. So I think the future looks bright in that respect. And I think that was basically it.
The other thing about epsilon is that the epsilon only works if you measure it for the radial orders that are basically have the strongest power, which also comes in paper. It's usually not that hard to measure, but it should be.
I mean, that's a C, right? It's a center.
Yeah, the center.
And it's the same for delta nu. That's the thing, you don't need a lot of modes. I mean, you just need to measure delta nu in the center, so nu max plus the two modes on the side, and then you measure epsilon in the same place. So even if your power spectrum is not very good, you can still determine these two parameters.
One comment, going back to what you were mentioning about kind of the juncture of the main sequence here, is if you have things like Gaia parallaxes, this actually makes these numbers, it does not replace this, it actually greatly amplifies it, right? Because then at that point, you have an independent luminosity, and that gives you a much tighter constraint on the mass that you have. And the other thing is in the subgiant branch, it also gives you constraint on things like helium. So in other words, I think the combination of Gaia parallaxes and astroseismology is really where you're going to have to go if you ever want to push like 1% as opposed to 10%.
No, absolutely. I mean, right, so. It's nothing against Gaia at all. I mean, I think it's going to be a great tool. The only thing is that if I will have to choose today for the giants, maybe I will drop the effective temperature. So then, sorry, Luca. But then you have delta nu, you have nu max, and you have the luminosity. And then you can basically replace one of the axes that you have with luminosity from Gaia.
Or you can overdetermine the system, you get helium, things like that. The other question I have is there, if you go back to the subgiants, there have been the fact that the mixed mode pattern is so exquisitely sensitive to the structure of the avoided crossings gives you at least notionally astonishingly precise ages. Could you comment on that? Better than basically sub percent.
In this case, you can do it. So you still have straight ridges in the L equals 0 and 2. The L equal 1, you see that there used to be a straight structure, and some of the modes are just flipping out. Now, this mode, for instance, used to be here, and it has moved towards outside and this one towards this side. That displacement is really, really quick. So you can actually match those modes with a stellar model, narrow side your range to. I mean, before you fold in systematics or anything like that, could be easily 5% or something like that.
But there we have to be very careful here, because it's very likely that we find a model with a different age, a different other parameters, and fit almost as well. Okay. So in the given vicinity of models, you get a very precise measurement of age, but it's not unique.
Yeah, sure.
And these are aspects we really don't understand in the depths and how soon.
I mean,
choose the best solution and what kind of uncertainty. How to describe it statistically, I mean, that's...
And so. Most likely this is also, I mean, this is basically telling you about the coupling between the core and the outer system. This is probably very sensitive to the size of the helium core.
Sure.
And that is, of course, very sensitive to the history of the main sequence, and that changes your turn of ages. And
I think that's actually what you're measuring.
Exactly. So you can actually, but that's actually a good thing. You can invert that exercise too.
Because again, just going to, if you want your next generation of precisions, if you really wanted to be able to pin things down really, really sharply, it's things like this.
Oh, yeah. Looking
at. Well, this is the thing is for the best, I will say the best Kepler data for the subgiants. Well, we have long, short cadence data, and these are the largest amplitude as well because they're the most luminous stars. So there are many of them with more than one, I mean, I think there's more than 60 or 50 with more than 1 year of short cadence data, which are very luminous. And of course, once we get parallaxes for those ones where the evolutionary tracks split even more, so we really, really lose.
So the number one test of Gaia is going to be to test the scalar relations, right? Because you can't derive distance. I mean, there's a little more dependence on the corrections and all that, but it's going to be small compared to what we're interested in. Testing them, so you can just, that's the first thing that.
Helium.
Helium. How much does the mixed modes influence your determination of delta nu? Is it significant?
Good point, because for these, sounds like these, you have to be really careful. If you just do a blind autocorrelation over all the entire power spectrum, you can get very balanced. So for red giants, it's usually fairly well behaved. They don't have to worry about it. But for subgiants, because these avoided crossings are much, much stronger and actually sometimes move all the way across the 0 and 2 range, you sometimes have to be careful and basically take away the L equals 1 modes and then read it to me.
But I presume you roughly know a range of delta nu where you expect.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't get, if you just do an autocorrelation, you might not get a peak that's at the right value because you have some other, there's a big small time period like that. And if you just fit that big, then you get on each other again. It's not. Sometimes you just have to look at each other again and basically do a trial and error in a way. But doing that in an automated way is more challenging.
So how much of a problem is it knowing the stellar models? I mean, you talk about accurate ages, but I guess
I never speak about accurate ages, like precise ages, but accurate never, just by definition.
So how much of the uncertainty comes from uncertainties in the stellar models?
That's the largest one right now, I would say. I mean, if you believe the scaling relations, and that's a different topic, but once you're there, especially for the clump, Maslow's is right now our biggest uncertainty that you can change it as you wish, and then you get changes of over 50, 70% in age, as simple as that, for the low mass stars.
So that PDF you were showing for your example star,
yeah,
that was...
These are RGB.
Okay.
It's dominated by
that
theory.
So or when you assume a certain... I mean, one of them was RGB, and then when you have RGB and clump, you assume a certain mass loss, for instance. So the thing is that when you determine stellar properties of a star that you know is in the clump, you determine its mass, right? And that's the actual mass, but you have no idea about the mass loss history. So it could be, if you detect 0.9, it could be born 0.9, or it could have been born 1.1 or 1.2, and the ages are going to be completely different. And until we don't get a good handle on mass loss, there's nothing we can do about it.
Is there any theoretical prediction? I'm making up things that we can't observe, but that you could get the age from figuring out the size of the core or anything like that, or still depends on the initial mass?
The core of the stars, the helium core is basically the same for all stars here because they all ignite helium at the same core mass, roughly, and the top. This is 0.48 solar masses. So.
Yeah, so near the main sequence, you have a nuclear clock, which is how much fuel you're
yeah,
burning. I think
sure.
My first question is, once you're on the giant branch, you've lost.
You lost it. You lose it during the subgiant phase. Mm-hmm. So. That's complete. I mean, if you have differences of, say, 10% at the turn off, once you get to the RGB, it's 4%. If so, it's just that the evolution through the main sequences, through the subgiant branch is much weaker. So, that doesn't really help us.
So, in one sense, they just are much better for what phases?
Sorry? Dwarfs, by far. Then, I mean, I think as you grow up, it gets worse, probably. Dwarfs are the better.
With all the worse it is.
But if the star is massive, it's also not a problem in terms of mass loss, right? Because mass loss is very small anyway. So over 1.5, 1.6, it doesn't.
Then the evolution is too quick for mass loss.
Then you worry about overshooting and this kind of thing. But if you are interested in an absolute age error of 1 giga-year, then you're also fine. Because relatively speaking, the uncertainty of overshooting may be large, but in absolute scale, it's not large.
But anyway, things like overshooting is, we can test it now with Kepler data. We couldn't before. So now we have abundant, I mean, that's where when the dwarfs comes in as a calibration sample for the giants. The giants might depend on the overshooting history in the main sequence, but we can test that with the dwarfs that we have. Then, of course, this period spacing in the clump phase is depends on the Brunn-Weissele frequency and therefore on the size of the core. So we have a way to measure the size of the core in the clump phase, and that tells you about the overshooting in the clump phase as well. So all these things can slowly be built up.
But the dwarf ages also depend on having the small frequency.
Sorry?
The dwarf ages depend on having the small frequency separation?
Yeah, I mean, we have a large sample. We have 120 stars with more than 12 months of short cadence data.
But so that's a slightly different technique than what you're doing here.
Yeah, of course. We don't use this. We use different techniques in the dwarfs. Then we narrow down age uncertainties as much as we can, fold in all the systematics that we have for stellar models, et cetera. And we try to learn about these mixing processes that can affect these other phases, like overshooting, for instance.
Modeling individual frequencies for giants is hard. It has not been done.
We haven't really done much
in Canada. Before,
so. It's tough, right?
Whereas for the dwarfs, we're now up to probably close to 100.
Because you have a powerful additional constraint, right, which is the luminosity is tied to the mass.
The thing is, a power spectrum looks something like, I mean, the predicted models look something like this, and then you give me these two modes. If you observe these two here, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, in this very tiny region, And then on top of that, I don't know if I'm predicting the right one, which is, I mean, I have no predictive power in terms of amplitudes, right? These ones depend, of course, on which mode you're resonating the amplitude check. I have no predictive power here. Well, we have the inertias, but.
We'll get there.
So this is the issue of modeling individual frequencies in red giants. That our theoretical models look like this. It's much more, and then you change something a bit, and you can still match these two. If you, I mean, there are no uncertainties here, right? You add the uncertainties to those, the broadness of the mode, and then you can basically match whatever you want. Not yet, but I think you
will. How do priors and age help you? Like, you know, if you do this in a cluster, for example, where you gauge better than.
I mean,
does that help you a lot, or does it is kind of irrelevant, or?
The thing is,
I just started thinking of people that determine ages in many different ways, and you know, they say, oh, in the subgiants I can do it, and I never do it here, I can never do it there. So, is that helping at all, or is it just kind of an irrelevant and not a good term?
I will look at it the other way. So, for instance, for the clusters that we have done, we don't use any prior in age, and we determine the same age that people have done with isochrones, right? So if you would have put that as a prior, you would end up in the same place in a way.
To help the frequency analysis.
But the problem is that these are field stars. How are you going to put priors in age?
But again,
the age of a cluster is determined by isochrones. And you take M67 and you find literature between 3.5 and 4.5 gigayears. How does that help you?
So
that's a good cluster.
I guess one thing you could do is you could measure mass loss on the giant branch. By comparing, in principle, if you have really good data.
Yeah.
So you can actually then, you have a coeval population, and then you have a mass transfer luminosity, you can measure that instead of guessing it. And it also just serves as a test, right? To first order, you have a theoretical prediction about, for example, all the giants on the giant branch should be the same mass or close to it.
So, I mean, that's, so Andrea did it, right? And in that case, for one cluster, the mass loss that he found was equivalent to Raymer's of 0.15 or something like that, which is, I mean, for global clusters, you need 0.4 because you have to reduce this very blue horizontal branch. For this normal or open clusters, somewhere, I mean, it's less. But then you have to try that for different clusters of different ages, different metallicities. So it's hard to find a prior in that, I guess.
But really, as I think one has to say, that any kind of constraint we get outside the association data helps. Somehow, and either to constrain the stars better or to test our methods better. That applies to being the cluster, that applies to having metallicity, that would apply to having a very good LP, which is unlikely.
Yeah.
Would apply to having a very good CF, which I can't see why you can't have, but that's.
But that's basically what we've been trying to do, right? I mean, we have done this with parallaxes testing our. These are interferometric measurements.
All right.
So this is the comparison between the. So this is the angular diameter measure with Bao, and this is the one combining seismology and the infrared flux method to predict the angular diameter. And
these are all
except a few giants, if I'm not mistaken. But so we're trying to increase this campaign. I mean.
This is best of the scale condition.
Exactly.
Well, you can invert it as well. I mean, we started observing. Targets in order to look at that to help the modelers get the frequencies with dwarfs and putting subgiants. In some cases, it's worked, but generally, actually, for the dwarfs, it seems like that measuring angular diameters to 1% and bring it to 2%, or at least in Travis Metcalf's paper, it seems like, or some papers, that it doesn't constrain the space a whole lot if you don't want the radius to be better than 1%, 2%. But for some stars,
Thank you both again.